Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey guys, before we get into the episode, I wanted to tell you a little bit about Paragons of Earth, the exciting new superhero comic I'm working on with Thomas DJ and Eric Johns. For this comic, we've unearthed a number of obscure and forgotten Golden Age superheroes, plucked them from the depths of the public domain, and completely redesigned and reinvented them for the modern day. It's an exciting cast of characters, and we're throwing them up against the threat of a Lovecraftian apocalypse. It's got action, it's got drama, it's got alternate dimensions and alien worlds, and it's even got a giant shark in a Hawaiian shirt. What else could you want? But in order to make this comic a reality, we need your help. The comic is crowdfunding now, and you can help support it by going to crowdfunder.com/paragonscomic. That's crowdfunder, without the E, .com/paragonscomic. You'll be able to find that link in the show notes, so please double check if you didn't quite get it. Please help make this comic a reality. We are counting on your support. And now, on with the show.
I'm a killer, with or without the monster, Eddie. You know what I really wanted?
What was it, Cletus?
Told you, but you weren't listening.
But I'm listening now.
I wanted your friendship.
I'm sorry, Cletus.
Fuck this guy!
Welcome to the Superhero Cinephiles podcast. I'm your host, Perry Constantine, and welcoming back a returning guest, and that is Liam Kerrigan. Liam, how are you doing today?
Great, Perry. Thanks for having me again. Looking forward to talking about this movie. It's a good one, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, I think we'll have some debate on that front, although you definitely came dressed for the occasion. You guys can't see on video, but Liam is wearing a Carnage sweatshirt right now.
Yep, you know, get your symbiote on. We're going to be talking symbiotes. So,
yeah. Before we jump too much into that, though, it's been a while since we've had you on the main show. You know, patrons will remember that you were on the Patreon show to talk about the Maximum Carnage comic book. But for listeners of the regular show, it's been a while. So why don't you remind them a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Okay, so I'm Liam. I'm based in Japan, like yourself, Perry. And I work as a journalist and a teacher, and I have had a long-running history of being right into comic books and comic book movies. You know, it all started with Christopher Reeve's Superman, but then in the early 90s, I got into Spider-Man quite a bit, thanks largely to the Sega Genesis / Sega Mega Drive, depending on where you are, video games, one of which was Maximum Carnage, which we talked about before, and which was one of the bases for the inspiration, which ended up becoming this movie that we're going to talk about today. So kind of a nice little symmetry to it all, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like I always ask, you know, guests, returning guests, new guests, what kind of stuff are you interested in lately? Is there anything that's been really kind of grabbing your attention these days?
Well, actually, I just started yesterday. I started watching Invincible, the animated series on Amazon. And that has been an interesting experience. The only reason I really wanted to watch it was because I got the new Mortal Kombat video game for PS5 a couple of months ago, and Omni-Man is going to debut as a character next week. So I wanted to see who the hell is Omni-Man. And watching the show, he's a bit of a character. I'll say that much without spoiling anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I've only seen the first episode of Invincible, actually. I haven't seen the rest of the series. It's one of those things that I checked out the first episode. I'm like, oh, yeah, that looks cool. And then just got distracted with other stuff. Didn't get a chance to getting around to watch it yet. Now the second season's out. Something I'm going to have to get on pretty soon. But I did read, also for the Patreon show, we read the first trade paperback of the comic series by Robert Kirkman, who also created The Walking Dead. And yeah, it was a really cool read. So that also is something made me want to go and check out the show a little bit more, too.
Yeah, I know nothing about the comics. I say I knew nothing about any of the characters until yesterday. But yeah, hopefully I can do that at some point as well, because certainly there's enough there in the first three episodes to keep me interested, that's for sure.
Yeah, apparently they shuffle things around from what happened in the comic books, because, you know, the first episode has that reveal about Omni-Man, but that doesn't happen in the first trade, which I think it collects the first 4 to 6 issues. It's just your standard teenage superhero story. It's not until I think like several issues in past that where they actually get into the Omni-Man stuff. And apparently it's from what my co-host, my guest on that one, Nick Baldwin, was saying, that they do it in a very different way from the animated series, and they play around with the concept a little bit different way. So if you like the TV show and you kind of want to see how the comic book did it differently, then it's not like a one-to-one translation.
Good. Sounds a bit like The Boys in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's the comparison I went with when he was telling me about that, because The Boys, I've read the comics and they're a lot deeper than a lot more complex than I actually expected on first glance. And then I watched the show, and the show goes in different directions from what the comics did. It's definitely an interesting way of doing it. Or if you also look at, you know, something like the MCU, they've been doing stuff like that too, where they kind of have similar starting points and then they've kind of deviated as time went on.
Hmm. Well, speaking of characters that kind of deviate from what we expect in the comics, that brings us back to Venom, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Yeah. Now, for my part, there's not really a whole lot I've been interested in lately. I've just been so busy between teaching classes and working on my comic book project, Paragons of Earth, crowdfunder.com without the e.slash Paragons comic, if you have not supported it yet. Just another note, even after the ad at the beginning of the episode, to support it again. So please make sure to back that. We've extended the funding period, so it is still accepting donations. But anyway, you know, shameless plug out of the way. Let's talk a little bit about Venom. Now, I think we're if not the same age, then at least very similar age. So we both came up in the same time period in the 90s when in the early 90s, when you had the whole Image craze and the whole anti-hero craze that was sweeping through comics, and the kind of, you know, creators taking the wrong lessons from Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns is what I always maintain. And one of the things that came out of that was, of course, this surge of popularity surrounding Venom in the early 90s. You know, Venom originally created, I think in the late 80s is when he first came out as a villain in the Spider-Man comics, and he proved so popular that Marvel decided, well, we're not going to keep him as a villain. We're going to make him an anti-hero. And there was like this slew of different limited series and one-shots and all sorts of different crossovers featuring Spider-Man and Venom. Like, obviously, Maximum Carnage being the most famous one, but there was also the first Carnage story arc that introduced the character, because they kind of realized that, oh crap, we had this great villain and we had to make peace with Spider-Man, and now we don't have a symbiote villain for Spider-Man to fight, so we have to create Carnage instead. And we talked a little bit about Carnage in the Patreon episode, so we might kind of be going over some familiar territory for people who listen to that episode. And then, you know, the Maximum Carnage video game and the comic book. There's the Separation Anxiety story, which also was a comic, which also was a video game too. And then Venom's popularity just kind of petered out after that point. Like, I think about like maybe mid late 90s is when people were starting to get sick of him, and he kind of just faded into the background a bit until, and Sony was obsessed with doing a Venom movie. So they forced Sam Raimi to include Venom in Spider-Man 3, to mixed results. We talked about that, you know, way back pre-episode 100 about Spider-Man 3. And then after they had made this new deal with Marvel, where Marvel would get the rights, Marvel would be able to make have Spider-Man appear in the MCU stuff, and they would be heavily involved in the solo Spider-Man movies that Sony was producing. But Sony still had the rights to all the other Spider-Man characters, which included Venom. So they tried to do this weird kind of Spider-Man universe thing, which they've been hung up on ever since the Amazing Spider-Man movies. And they did the first Venom movie with Tom Hardy without Spider-Man. And then they tried to expand it with Morbius, which obviously didn't work so well. They're still trying with the upcoming Kraven the Hunter movie, which also looks like it's not that great. So we'll see how things work out there. But just with the Venom side of things, what's kind of your feeling about the character? What was your feeling about his appearances in the movies and that sort of stuff?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm glad that they did decide to revisit Venom after Spider-Man 3, because I was very annoyed with that film, to have, spoiler alert, you know, one of my favorite Spider-Man villains stroke heroes show up and basically be taken out within 10 minutes and very much made to be a one and done disposable character, especially after being built up for as long as he was in that movie with the black suit on Peter Parker beforehand and whatever. So I'm glad they went back to it, but I think that to enjoy Venom and Venom Let There Be Carnage, you have to kind of accept that this is a different take. It's lighter, it's more kind of, it's more comedic, it's definitely less gritty. But to be honest, after having watched The Batman not long before I saw Venom Let There Be Carnage, this was the perfect tonic, actually, because that movie was far too dark for me. So, yeah. It's just a case of, you know, go into it, but if you go into it expecting like mid-90s Lethal Protector edgy Venom, you're going to be disappointed. But if you go in there expecting just a fun, goofy comic book action movie, you're probably going to take away quite a lot from it.
Yeah, it does surprise me that you thought the Batman was too dark. I had the opposite appeal of that. But when it came to the first Venom movie, I still remain kind of a defender of Venom in Spider-Man 3. Not, I think you're absolutely right that he was built up too much, and he was not really and wasn't really quite executed the way it should have been in the end. Although I thought Topher Grace was doing some interesting things as kind of like this, you know, this dark version of Peter Parker. And I thought he did a pretty good job in his performance, but the script just didn't do him any favors in that movie.
He deserved to be more than a one and done villain, based on that performance. Definitely. I mean, a bit like Andrew Garfield, Spider-Man, actually, you know, studio things go on in the background out of their control, and that's two guys who both nailed the roles they were in and deserved to have a lot more than what they actually got in the end.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I co-sign that completely. And I think at one point they were actually talking about doing a Venom spinoff with Grace reprising the role, but that never came to pass because, you know, obviously they decided to not go ahead with Spider-Man 4, which Raimi had originally planned on doing, and then they decided to reboot the whole thing. And of course, this is also kind of timely because now there's the PS5 Spider-Man 2 game that just came out, which also has Venom in it. And I think one of the biggest problems of Spider-Man 3 is that they tried to do way too much in that movie, right? They were trying to close out the Goblin trilogy aspect with, you know, Harry assuming his father's mantle, which the second movie teased at the end. Then they were also trying to introduce the Sandman, and then they decided to throw in Venom in there too, and the black suit, which really I think they should have closed off the Goblin trilogy with just Harry, maybe have Sandman appear as a minor antagonist or something, and then they should have done a new trilogy that would have been focused on the symbiote. So they should have had, I think, the first, you know, Spider-Man 4 should have been him getting the black suit, him dealing with that. Should have ended with Brock then getting the symbiote. Second movie should have been Brock getting the symbiote. And then maybe the third movie you do Carnage. I don't know. That's one way I think you could have done it. But I really, and so when they announced that they were going to do a Venom movie and it wasn't going to involve Spider-Man, I was very skeptical about how they would make that work. But I also wasn't against it like a lot of fans were. I know a lot of people when that first announcement came out or when the first teaser trailer was released, they were very much against it. But I thought it had some promise. Tom Hardy obviously is a great actor. He looks more like the classic depiction of Eddie Brock than Topher Grace does as well. So it was clear he was going to be playing more of a more comics accurate version of Eddie Brock, as opposed to just the dark Peter Parker version that Grace played. And then when the movie came out, I was so impressed by how much I enjoyed it, especially the odd couple dynamic of it with Venom and the symbiote, which is something you don't even get a lot of in the comics, really, right? There is the whole, you know, the symbiote, there's the, you know, he's always referring to himself as we and that kind of stuff. But you don't always get a whole lot of dialogue between the symbiote and Eddie like you did in that first movie. They've started to adapt that in the comics now. But originally, and I might be totally misremembering this, but I don't recall a whole lot of dialogue between the symbiote and the host in the comics. Do you?
No, I mean, just going back to when I reread Maximum Carnage before the Patreon show that we did, it was, apart from, like you say, the pronoun we, there was very little to tell you that there was two personalities there. Mm-hmm. You know, you would just say things like, oh yeah, we have to stop Carnage, and it was like, yeah, but apart from that, where does Venom play into this? Apart from that, it was just Eddie Brock talking most of the time. So yeah, that's definitely something that, I mean, it was there, but I think that it's been expanded upon a lot more, probably since the first Venom movie came out, and clearly mm-hmm. I think comics are taking direction from that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I thought that was something that worked very well in the movie, especially because Tom Hardy did both, you know, obviously Eddie Brock, but he also did the voice of the symbiote, and I can't recall if they had done a whole lot of heavy post-production work on the voice or if that's mostly him using a different voice. Thankfully he didn't use the Bane voice from Dark Knight Returns. No.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was what I loved about that first movie, was just that odd couple pairing. And I thought the supporting cast was really good. The main thrust of the story, the whole, you know, billionaire who was, you know, trying to go into space and he gets the symbiote as well, that stuff felt very kind of like, you know, early 2000s standard superhero movie plot. So that didn't really impress me, but it was more the characterization of Eddie, his interactions with the symbiote, as well as with Anne and even Dan too. Like, I was surprised how much I really liked Dan in that first movie. Yeah. It's so funny. I'm not sure if you've ever seen Veep, but Reed Scott, who plays Dan, he's in that too. And he plays like the polar opposite character from the Venom movies, where in Veep, he is just like the smarmiest, most opportunistic asshole you have ever met. And then to see him then playing like this super nice guy who is so understanding, it's just, and he does them both perfectly.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, definitely that's the range of a good actor right there. Mm-hmm. But with the first Venom movie, it's funny actually. I rewatched both of them last week to prepare for this, and my wife made an interesting observation because she hadn't seen either of them. We were watching them for the first time, and she said, "Is this guy meant to be based on Elon Musk?" I was like, "Well, actually." The movie was made a few years before Elon Musk went full Lex Luthor. So actually, no, but looking back on it, yes, it kind of makes sense that it might have been. And she also said that, you know, in light of everything that was going on after the movie with the pandemic and whatever, she drew some parallels between the Life Foundation and like big pharmaceutical companies. And I said, well, I think that was an intended bit of commentary there, but maybe a little bit too heavy-handed.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously that movie was pre-pandemic, but I think they were drawing more from the opioid crisis and all that kind of stuff in America. I think that's where they got most of the ideas for that part of it. And I think I could be wrong, but my impression of that guy in the first movie was that maybe he was based more on Martin Shkreli, if anyone remembers that guy. The pharma bro billionaire they were calling him back in the day.
The second most punchable face in popular media after Nigel Farage, in my opinion.
I don't know. Elon Musk is definitely up there too. So
it's
tough to say which one I'd want to see punched more. I mean, I think right now Musk kind of tops it, but but now I was really looking forward to this movie. I mean, especially because the first movie ended with the post-credit stinger of Woody Harrelson as Cletus Cassidy, who, as we all know, is the host of the Carnage symbiote. Although they gave him a absolutely god-awful wig in that movie.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Ditching the wig was the first good move this second movie made.
Yeah,
because that did look ridiculous. Yeah.
So I was really looking forward to this movie, especially because, you know, Andy Serkis was taking over as director, and, you know, with all of his experience with motion capture, you know, he seemed like the perfect guy to direct a movie like this. So I was totally on board for this. And then it came out, and honestly, I don't know. I think you said you actually really liked this movie. I was actually kind of disappointed with it. It did not do for me what the first movie did. I think it pales in comparison to the first movie. I feel like they kind of wasted Carnage in this, and there's just a lot of missteps, which we can probably break down as we go further in the discussion.
No, I mean, what I would say is, personally, I enjoyed it, but I can totally see how people who really enjoyed the first movie might see it as a step down. Mm-hmm. Because like you say, Carnage is, in my opinion, too good a villain to be one and done, which he very clearly is by the end of this movie. It's a bit like, a much, much better movie, but if you think about the Batman 1989 example, right? Great, great movie. But on reflection, they probably regret killing the Joker at the end of that movie because that was such a big character that you could have done so much more with him. And I think Carnage falls into a similar boat, whereas, like, again, going back to the comic books, the whole point of Carnage was that he necessitated Venom and Spider-Man getting together because it's like, we need to put our own beef aside here because this guy could kill both of us. Whereas here, he's just kind of negated to like the stock villain of this movie pretty much as Riot was in the first movie.
Yeah.
And it's like Carnage is on a much higher tier than Riot, and the movies haven't really reflected that.
Well, yeah, I mean, to that point, that big showdown in the church when the symbiote says, "Oh no, it's a red one." I'm just like, "What, wasn't Riot a red one in the last movie too?" If I'm misremembering, but I think pretty sure he was red as well. And there's never any explanation as to why Venom is so scared of the Carnage symbiote. It's just like that one line, and it's never been hinted at before. It's never mentioned again. It's never really shown through the movie why he would be so afraid of Carnage. So that was very kind of baffling to me.
I'll bet that that was probably one of the things that was cut down when the studio necessitated the movie be cut down to 90 minutes.
Oh, I see.
I'll bet there's a script out there somewhere in the two-hour R-rated cut of Venom Let There Be Carnage, which was originally envisioned, which probably expands on that quite a bit. That was a plot hole for me as well. So
Mike, I was not aware of this. So I'm guessing then that this is kind of similar to the Daredevil situation from the movie where, you know, it was originally like this 2-hour long movie and then the studio cut it down to 90 minutes. And that's why the story of the theatrical cut is pretty nonsensical. And then when you compare it to the director's cut is actually, you know, ridiculously superior.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if a 2-hour version was ever actually filmed. I don't know if it's like a Justice League scenario or not. But what I do know is that the movie was originally envisioned to be longer, but executives said, no, we want a 90-minute movie so we can maximize the... Because, again, this was just coming out of the pandemic, you know, late 2021 release, and they wanted to really try and get as much revenue in as they could, because I think they knew they were going to lose money on this regardless, because it had been baking for so long in the studio. Because remember, this movie was supposed to come out a full year before it eventually did.
Right, yeah.
And that's unfortunate, because I really think that, I don't know if there is a 2-hour cut of the movie out there somewhere, but if there is, I'd sure like to see it, because I do think there's that, and there's a number of other little plot threads that don't quite get fixed up. I mean, I think you could do a lot more as well, exploring the sort of relationship between Carnage and Cassidy. Mm-hmm. You know, we both agree that one of the major strong points of both these movies is the dynamic between Eddie and Venom. Whereas every time, like, there's something between Carnage and Cassidy, it's basically like, shut up or I'll kill your wife, and then that's it. It kind of shuts down there, and there's not really an exploration of that. I thought, you know, having Carnage as, for want of a better phrase, the anti-Venom would have been a bit more interesting, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. And you just touched on something there that I didn't think of before, but this has the exact same problem that Spider-Man 3 had, where, again, they're kidnapping the love interest and having her held prisoner as a way to get the hero. I mean, like, it's the exact same plot thread from that yeah. movie. Even that final battle scene is, you know, not all that dissimilar. Especially, and it was such a huge step down from the first movie, where Anne uses the symbiote to save Eddie. Where they had completely inverted that whole idea. And then here they just go back to the cliche. That was kind of disappointing. But also, too, they have that. They also retread familiar ground where they still have the symbiote and Anne merged together very briefly. And I'm just like, you know, it felt like they were playing things safe and they weren't going as far as they should have with a character like Carnage, or with this plot or this situation.
Yeah. This movie definitely has elements of filming by committee about it, unfortunately. And I think you've just hit on one of the major ones there. Anne definitely takes a step back as a character compared to what she was in the first movie. And it's a shame, because I really like that actress, and I really think that the role was, you know, I was hoping we might actually get more of Lady Venom in the second movie as like another character, because I thought that was what they were teasing in the first movie, but clearly it wasn't. It was just an Easter egg for people that read the comics.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Michelle Williams, it's clear that she's having fun in these movies. I mean,
yeah,
that when she says that line about where she's like, not again, and she's like, well, you know, maybe. I mean, it's actually a lot of fun.
yeah.
Well, I was going to say that I think the biggest weakness for me in this movie, though, is the inclusion of Shriek, because it you know, talking about plot holes, that's a huge plot hole that it sets up, because we are not in the MCU here, right, where you have, you know, all these different super beings who exist. This has been established as being a separate universe, and the most supernatural thing that we've seen so far in these movies is the symbiote. That's the only thing we've seen. There's never been any sort of hint as to why Shriek has these powers. It just, she's had them. In the comics, she's a mutant, so we know that, but mutants have not been established as being part of this reality. So that just, it's just taken as a given that, you know, there are people who have superpowers in this universe. And it just feels very, it feels like they didn't know how to give her superpowers. And they just said, well, let's just keep them as she was born. She had them since she was a little kid.
Yeah. There was that one throwaway line about mutation. And the other thing is, you know, I think, again, talking about what I think was probably executive interference, is that clearly whoever made the choice to put that line in the movie was not aware it was going to trigger a whole fan base thing about, oh, does this mean the X-Men are in this universe? Mm. You know, and it was unfortunate because clearly that was not a direction that they wanted to go in. But as soon as you say mutation, something which hadn't come up in the MCU by that point,
right,
you're like, oh, does this mean we're getting mutants? And no, it doesn't. It's just a throwaway line to explain dropping this character into the story.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a shame because I do like what they did with Shriek in the sense that they actually made her a fleshed out character as opposed to just this psychopath who pairs up with another psychopath in the comic books. You know, having her and Cassidy basically be a couple from childhood was, I think, quite an interesting take on it. And, you know, initially you do have sympathy for her, but then, of course, as time goes on, you realize, no, she's just another psychopath. But it's funny that in a movie where Carnage is supposed to be the centerpiece, that Shriek is actually the more developed character of the two, which is weird. Because, you know, it's the complete opposite in the comic books. Shriek is just a henchwoman to the main man, Carnage, whereas here they have a kind of 50-50 dynamic almost.
And I think that whole, you know, the natural born killers angle thing, you know, similar to the other movie Harrelson was in the 90s, that would have worked very well, I think, but not in this movie. I think you first have to establish Carnage as his own character first, and then, you know, you probably see, you know, in Shriek, and you lay the groundwork for bringing her in later, but you don't actually see her until maybe like a post credits thing or something like that, and then you bring her in the next movie. I thought would have made a lot more sense.
Yeah, because like you know, going back to what we said before, Carnage should fight Spider-Man and Venom. That should be how you bring the character to its pinnacle. Whereas, unfortunately, because of whatever here they've had him as, he's the villain. He's done by the end of this movie. And the thing is, now for Venom 3, where do you go? Because, all right, it's hinted that Toxin is going to come into the movie at some point. But, you know, Toxin is not on the same level as Carnage. And unless they're going to have him fight Null, which in my opinion is unfortunately pretty much unfilmable as a movie because that character has got so much going on, you know, anything else is going to be a step down from Carnage. So that's, they kind of sort of creatively written themselves into a corner there, you know.
Well, also too, it's how many times are we going to keep going to, you know, Venom has to battle another symbiote route. I mean, if it's, you know, we had Riot in the first one, we have Carnage in this one, and then if we bring in Toxin in the third one, I think there's going to be a definite sense of fatigue setting in with the audience.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you know, I like Tom Hardy and Venom. I like what they're doing with him, even if it is very different from some aspects of the comic. But yeah, they're going to have to really up the stakes here because Carnage is, you know, Carnage is to Venom what the Joker is to Batman. And now that he's off the table, where do you go? I really don't know. I mean, I'm sure they'll think of something, but I just get the feeling it's going to be, you know, you said yourself, you come away from this movie feeling quite unfulfilled in a number of ways. I'm worried I'm going to have the same feeling with the next movie because my favorite villain is done and gone. So,
yeah. And also too, I mean, I think what would have been interesting is if you introduce Carnage in this movie, and because at some point they knew they were going to have, you know, Venom connected to the MCU, right? With the credit sequence where he gets transported to the MCU. And, you know, fortunately they do it in a way that's actually pretty clever, right? Unlike Morbius, where it's just, you know, Michael Keaton appearing in the Morbius universe doesn't make a lick of sense. It just does not work at all. But in this movie, it actually does make sense, right? The symbiote says that, you know, we share a hive mind that spans the multiverse. And that's an interesting concept. So it makes sense why when Doctor Strange's spell starts pulling in characters who know Spider-Man is Peter Parker, that's why the Venom symbiote ends up getting brought into the MCU. That made total sense. I thought that was a really cool way of doing it. And that could have been a good setup for Maximum Carnage, right? If you had, you know, Venom being brought in. I mean, presumably then Carnage could also have been brought into the MCU as well. And then you would have had Venom and Spider-Man having to team up to stop Carnage. I think that would have been a much better way to go about it than what we saw, what we got here.
Yeah. I mean, and also you could have the, you know, if you kept the thing going with like the multiple Spider-Men, you could have Tobey Maguire say, wait a minute, I've fought this guy before. He is not a good guy. And then, you know, but our Venom now is much more sympathetic. And how do you bridge that, you know, with the idea of, you know, our previous Spider-Man fought this guy as an out and out villain, whereas this Venom is definitely not a villain. And how does the current Spider-Man deal with that? You know, there's so much they could have done there rather than just have a post-credit stinger that doesn't go anywhere. It's a shame.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought another thing that the film did well, though, just like in the first movie, is that odd couple dynamic. The fact that they're having all these growing pains, you know, living together and you know, with Venom constantly wanting to eat people's brains and, you know, Eddie always being like, no. So that, you know, we have to only eat chickens or chocolate.
Yeah, that whole sequence where like Venom decides to go on a night out, he goes to the nightclub and whatever. That is, I mean, it's stupid, but it's funny. I like that.
Well, I also like that they've got this, you know, they've got this friendship with Mrs. Chen, and how she's like, you know, how she tries to blackmail him at one point.
Yeah, she's definitely one of the one of those great little kind of side characters that just enhances whatever any scene that she's in.
And also like when the symbiote possesses her and she's talking to Anne, I thought, again, she plays that part so well in that scene.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. I mean, it to me, that was one of the most understated yet funny lines of the movie, where like Eddie walks into the store, it's just like, "Hi, Eddie. Hi, Venom." It's just such a normal thing for the guy to have this alien attached to him, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Another thing I had an issue with was the way they depicted the relationship between Carnage and Cassidy. One of the trademarks of Carnage in the comics is that he is kind of possessing the symbiote, right? He doesn't think of the symbiote as a partnership. He is, you know, unlike other symbiote hosts where they have this relationship with the symbiote, Carnage doesn't. Like the symbiote is almost like, you know, a pawn of Carnage, of Cletus. He is, you know, he's like, you know, controlling the symbiote. He's like almost holding it prisoner. Like he doesn't refer to it as we, he refers to himself as I.
Yeah, but I mean, if I'm right in thinking in the comic books, that's something to do with the fact that he absorbed it into his blood, whereas other symbiotes bond with a host like at the exterior level. So yeah, it was much more of a complete takeover when Cassidy bonded with Carnage. So yeah, It's a complicated one.
Yeah, I think I remember reading at some point somewhere, and this is like, I'm half remembering this from like, you know, 20 years ago, so I apologize if I'm getting things wrong. But I think it also had something to do with Cletus's own insanity, which is why he is, he's not as, you know, which is why he doesn't view it as a partnership. He just views it as like his possession instead.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, I think that, I don't know if any writers ever publicly admitted this, but to me, Carnage, as you see him in the early 90s, was clearly written as, what if the Joker had superpowers? You know, basically, that's exactly the angle they're going for, because he's not, like you say, it's not this back and forth. He is just a psychopath who has just had a major power up.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what it is.
See, I had briefly tried to look it up, and I couldn't find out what the reference is. So I could be completely wrong on that, about the mentality. But whatever the case, whatever the reason was, I thought that it was kind of a missed opportunity to not show that Carnage and Cletus have a very different relationship to Eddie and Venom. And while they do try to differentiate them in some small way by, you know, obviously it's slightly more antagonistic, I felt that by having Carnage be like kind of like the dominant force in their relationship, it almost kind of diminishes Cassidy a bit. I don't know. What did you think about that?
Yeah, I would kind of agree with that, because, you know, Cassidy in the comic books is not in any way a sympathetic character. He is a vicious, murdering, evil being.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Carnage comes along, all that does is enhance every negative aspect of his character. Whereas here, he's almost sympathetic at times. You know, it's like, don't you hurt my wife. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, I'm sorry, but I'm not supposed to feel sorry for Carnage. You know?
Yeah.
And yet, here we are. I'm like, oh my God, Cletus Cassidy, that's a shame. He, you know, all he wants is to have a friend, you know. And I'm like, no, this is not the angle you go down with this character.
Well, yeah, that annoyed me. That thing at the end where he says, yeah. Oh, I just wanted to be your friend, Eddie. I'm like, where the fuck did that come from? And that could be another example of, you know, like you were saying, maybe it was something that was cut down and was, you know, kind of like a remnant of what was supposed to be a longer movie. But whatever the case, it makes no sense in the context of this movie.
To me, though, that bit isn't really about him. It's to set up what I think is the best single use of an F-bomb in a PG-13 movie ever. And I'm just like, oh, fuck this guy, crunch.
Yeah. Yeah. And if that was the case, it didn't. It felt like Cletus was being genuine in that. It felt like the movie was actually trying to push that point of view, even though, you know, you do get that next line after that. But still, it was just, it just felt very tacked on to me.
Yeah, I, like you say, I think there's probably a deeper story there that we'll probably never see, unfortunately. But I do love that line from Venom, though. Because if I'm right in saying in America that's the rules, isn't it? PG-13, you get one F word.
Yeah, I think it's like one or two, something like that. But yeah, those are generally the rules. So they
use that one to maximum effect.
They definitely found the best use of that one line. Yes, absolutely. So talk about some other stuff. What did you think of Mulligan in this, who will end up becoming, possibly end up becoming Toxin in a sequel?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. It's good in these kind of movies when you get like the cop or the detective who is on the periphery and isn't fully aware of what's going on. So a lot of it, he's like, what the hell is this? And as time goes on, he moves deeper into it and becomes aware of it. Reminded me a little bit of, and, you know, apologies if listeners haven't seen this, but the original Highlander movie.
Mm-hmm.
A major side plot of that movie is the police saying, like, who's running around cutting all these guys' heads off? And they'd know nothing about Immortals or the Gathering or whatever, and they're trying to make sense of it all. And I thought there was an element of that in the Mulligan character. He's like, aliens, symbiotes, what the hell is going on here? Mm-hmm. And he's trying to kind of figure it out. And then, of course, at the end, as we say, with the hint towards toxin, he's getting fully sucked into this world now.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I thought he was... Again, I think there are elements of a good movie here where you've got Mulligan trying to use Eddie to find the remains of Cletus's murder victims. But, you know, tying him in with, you know, Shriek and all that, I felt like it didn't really quite work as well. And he just feels kind of there throughout most of this movie. Mm. And it feels like they're so focused on this idea of seeding him in for a possible sequel, just like they did with Tyrese's character in Morbius. It felt very similar to that aspect of it.
Yeah, and to be honest, that is my biggest peeve that I have with current superhero movies, and, you know, Star Wars is another example of it, whereas, like, can you please just focus on doing this movie well instead of, like, planting story plot points that are going to pay off 3 or 4 movies down the line? You know, it really, that is something about modern cinema that actively agitates me. I don't want to have to spend 2 hours reading up on Wikipedia for films I don't have time to watch just so I can understand what's going on in the film I'm about to see, you know? I mean, case in point, last night we watched on domestic TV here in Japan, they had Spider-Man Far From Home last night. So we watched that. And at the end of it, there was a preview for the Marvels movie. And my wife was like, oh, that looks good. Let's go see it. And I'm like, yeah, but we need to watch Captain Marvel first. If we don't watch Captain Marvel, we're not going to have a clue who any of these characters are. So, you know, I don't like movies that give me homework.
I mean, I'm of two minds on that. Like, I, you know, coming from the comics background, I do love the interconnected aspects of it. But also, you make a very good point. Like, I think they take it too far. I thought when it's done well, it works really well. Like, I think The Avengers was a very good way of doing that, where they had you know, they had introduced some stuff to seed stuff in. But that movie, if you watch The Avengers in isolation, you can still follow it pretty well. Like, they do a pretty good job of giving you all the information you need to know. Or the Guardians movies too. That's another good example of, you know, films that do a very good job of setting it within this universe, but still focusing on the story they're trying to tell. And yeah, there are some little Easter eggs here and there that might pay off in the future, but it's not, you know, it's not the focus. Whereas I feel like something like, you know, introducing Mulligan in this movie, or introducing, you know, whoever Tyrese's character was in Morbius, that feels like the studio is focusing more on, let's introduce stuff for the sequels, which were not planned yet, instead of developing a good story for this movie.
Yeah, and I, you know, I don't mean to crap on what I thought was a perfectly serviceable movie, but that's when you end up with a Black Adam scenario. You
know? Yes.
You plant this major, major build-up for another movie that is just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. I will crap on Black Adam. I was very disappointed with that movie. Yeah, that's another one that I'll have to, you know, we'll see about talking about at some point. But that was just a massive disappointment. Especially what happened at the end of it. So, you know, I feel so bad for Henry Cavill being used as a pawn in Dwayne Johnson's power games.
Yeah, although going back to what I said before, the one good thing of that is we're probably going to get a new Highlander movie earlier than we thought we were, thanks to Henry Cavill being free now.
yeah. Or maybe him as James Bond. Like, that's another one that's been thrown around a lot. Which, you know, after
that's one that should have happened. That, I mean, should have happened 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, after seeing him in Man from U.N.C.L.E., like, I don't know why you didn't fire Daniel Craig right away and cast Henry Cavill after that movie.
Yeah,
those are kind of some of the biggest things that bothered me about this. I mean, I did like that we got to see a little bit more of Reed Scott and Michelle Williams, although I felt that they weren't used as effectively in this movie as they were in the last movie. Like, here, as great it is seeing them again, it did feel a little bit like they weren't quite they didn't have a really good way to integrate them into this movie.
I did like at the end though, where Venom says, like, you know, Dan, you take care as well. Mm-hmm. And you know, because at the end of the first movie, he's like, we're going to get her back.
Yeah.
Whereas now he's like, yeah, Dan's a good guy. Dan's all right. Dan can have her. You know, he's it was just a nice bit of closure for that particular story arc. I think that you can see, Eddie and Venom are ready to move on from Anne. And you can see that Dan is nothing but a nice guy throughout the entirety of the two movies, despite everything he has to deal with.
That's what I like too, you know, one of the things that still drives me insane about Spider-Man 2 is how MJ leaves John Jameson at the altar, who is the nicest freaking guy in that movie. Whereas Peter Parker is being a jerk throughout the whole movie. And then she leaves him at the altar for Peter. That every time I watch that movie, I want to stop after he drops her off at home before the wedding scene, because that whole ending just pisses me off.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was Superman Returns was another movie like that, where you had the character, I can't remember the character's name, but the one that was with Lois Lane. And
Richard.
I'm like, unless you kill this guy off in the next movie, there's no good way to resolve this that doesn't make Superman look like a total dick, you know?
But I think they did find a good way to resolve it in that movie, because this is on my mind, because we had just recently re-released the episode where Derek and I had talked about Superman Returns as part of the SCP Classic feed. But one of the things that really impressed us about that movie was the moment when he takes her up into above the Daily Planet and they're flying, and then he sets her back down. They almost kiss and they stop and he pulls away. Like, for me, when I saw that movie, when I was rewatching it, I'm like, that's the moment when they both realize it's over between them. And from that point on, you know, he realizes, you know, Richard's a good guy. Richard's a good man. I'm going to step back and step out of the way. Mm-hmm. And obviously the thing that you're going to have to resolve, which they never ended up getting around to doing, was the parentage thing. But, but outside of that, I thought the idea of him taking a step back and basically being like, you know, them almost being like a divorced couple was a very interesting way to do it. And I wish we could have seen what would have happened in the next movie. So I did like that Richard ends up getting the girl in the end of that movie, just like I like that Dan ends up getting the girl in these movies, because in both cases, because most of the time in these movies, when you're setting up a love triangle, the third point on that triangle is almost always an asshole. Doesn't matter if it's male or if it's female, it's almost always going to be an asshole character who is wrong for the love interest. And what I like that Superman Returns did, what I like that the Venom movies did, is that they did not make that character an asshole. They made him a good guy in both cases. And in both cases, you know, the main character ends up losing out, but you're okay with that decision, right? They handle it in a pretty mature way. And I like that aspect of it.
Yeah. I mean, I would totally agree with that. I think when I said, how do you resolve it? I was talking from the sense of, like, after Superman Returns, establishing the comic book status quo, when it's Superman and Lois together. And there was no way to do that, because she was clearly happy with Richard, and Richard was a good guy by the end of that movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, ties in exactly to what you were saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would have been interesting to see. But anyway, we're not here to talk about Superman Returns. what did you think of Naomi Harris as Shriek? We talked about her role in the movie, but we haven't talked so much about her performance.
I think you've got a very, very good actress there who is given very little to do. Her best scenes are early on in the movie when she's very much the victim.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's being held in this high security prison and tested like a lab rat, when at that point you don't really think she's done anything wrong. But then when she gets out, she just goes full villain and becomes a much less interesting character at that point, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Even though Naomi Harris does play, you know, she's really good at doing that sort of over-the-top, hammy villain thing. But to me, the character loses something once you make that transition.
Yeah, I mean, she's such a good actress, and she really deserved better than what she got in this. And I think even to an extent, the same could be said for Woody Harrelson, although he gets a little bit more. And early on, I think he does a pretty good job. Like, I think the best scenes with Cletus are when he's in the prison and when he's talking with Eddie. But then after he breaks out and he merges with the Carnage Symbiote, like we said, he kind of becomes almost subordinate to Carnage, and that seems to be in a misguided attempt to try and make him relatable. And then you got him being, you know, obsessed with rescuing Shriek and all that. And it kind of falls apart. It feels like Harrelson is not really able to cut loose in the way that we know he can. Because if you get the Woody Harrelson from Natural Born Killers, like that is the perfect pick for Cletus Cassidy. Like, you know, you could not engineer a better casting decision. And yet this script doesn't really do the character or Harrelson's abilities as an actor any real favors.
Yeah, and it's a shame because I remember as far back as the early 2000s, you know, people fan casting. Everybody wanted Woody Harrelson for Carnage. Mm-hmm. They all thought that's perfect. That's dream casting. And then when you see at the end of the first movie, it is him. You're like, oh, that's perfect. That is just such a good pick.
Bad wig aside.
And yeah, and then it just doesn't. Yeah, yeah. So Sideshow Symbiote or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, it's a shame because it's a real, real missed opportunity there.
Yeah.
Like you say, this could be a multi-movie villain. He could be a villain with so much more going on. And again, like Shriek, his best parts are before he becomes superpowered and goes full psycho.
Yeah.
The whole sort of like slow speaking, understated kind of like this very, very creepy, but trying somehow to be sympathetic, mm-hmm. Character that he is in prison is much more interesting than just the mass murdering red monster that he becomes later on.
Yeah. I think they also miss an opportunity to show sort of to draw a more interesting contrast between Venom and Carnage, because, you know, in the comics, there is this idea that, Venom is a monster, but he does have some sense of morality, however twisted it might be, whereas Carnage has no morality. Whereas in this one, you know, you do get some of that with Venom, but the fact that Eddie is so against him killing, it kind of dilutes that concept a little bit. And then you get almost like, you know, a standard hero-villain difference. Whereas I think if Eddie had embraced Venom's, you know, ideas of being a lethal protector and being able to kill criminals, I think it would have made for a more interesting contrast with Carnage.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And there's also what I think is kind of a major plot hole in the movie that's created through this whole Carnage Venom dynamic. Right. So we go with the assumption that Carnage is the dominant of the pair. Mm-hmm. Right. When Cassidy gets out, the first thing he wants to do is go and rescue Shriek. Now, if Carnage, as happened when Venom bonded with Eddie, if Carnage has absorbed all of Cassidy's memories and knowledge, whatever, he knows that her superpower is Sonic. So he should be like, we're not going anywhere near that because that could kill me.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I didn't even think about that. But yeah, you're 100% right.
Yeah, so really, if Carnage is the dominant one and is like as brutal as he appears to be towards the end of the movie, he should be like, no, we're not going anywhere near her. Mm-hmm. Forget her. We've got other more important things to do.
Not even forget her. Like, he probably would have, with how dominant he was, he probably would have just killed her outright. I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. That is a huge plot hole that the movie just does not address at all. I mean, in summation, I think this is a movie that it had so much potential, and it just feels like it was really squandered. I mean, even with the whole idea about, you know, trying to get back the former lover, that's another area where you could have drawn some more interesting contrast between Venom and Carnage, and they just don't. Like, there are all these ideas that are there, but they're not touched on at all.
Yeah, because the other thing is that, you know, as I said, up until she gets out of prison, Shriek is quite a sympathetic character. You know, fair enough, you could have had her, like, murder those doctors that tortured her. You know, if she killed them, you say, well, fair enough, that's revenge. But then I would have liked to have had a bit, maybe later in the movie, where she's to, like, you know, she says to Carnage, right, stop, this is too much, we're going too far here. Because there's not enough there to buy that she would be as evil as he is. And yet she quite happily jumps on board with all that. And that didn't sit easy with me when I was watching the movie.
No, I agree completely. Yeah. And I think it's probably a good note to end on here, is that this is just, it's a movie that had so much potential. And I mean, and you know, I'm not saying like, it's not like we're talking about The Dark Knight or Iron Man with the first Venom movie. I mean, it wasn't, you know, a stellar example of superhero movies, but it was a fun movie. And I feel like this, even that, I mean, it's not, it even, I mean, I you know, on Letterboxd, I think I gave, you know, the first movie, like maybe three and a half stars or something like that. So it's a fun movie. It's a movie that I'll watch every now and again, but it's not something that I'm going to hold up as like a pinnacle of superhero movies. But so the bar is not that high to make a good sequel to this movie. And it feels like they just didn't really try hard enough. It felt very phoned in a lot of respects.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy it for what it is. It's just, it's a dumb action movie with some funny moments, and it's kind of bubblegum viewing, you know. It's harmless. It's kind of, you know, you can, but for people like us who know the potential these characters could have, that's where you get a bit disappointed with it. Yeah, it's a disappointing movie. I'm personally not as disappointed with it as I think you are, but I can definitely see a lot of missed potential in, to me, what is a middling but reasonably enjoyable film.
Right. Yeah. I think they're just, it's funny. They made the same mistake with, it's funny. These studios keep making the same mistakes, right? X-Men with the Dark Phoenix movies. They made the same mistake both times. They tried to cram too much story into one movie. And then Spider-Man 3 and Let There Be Carnage, they make the same mistake with Venom both times. They keep trying to cram too much into these movies. I mean, you don't do the symbiote story and Venom at the same time. You don't do Carnage's introduction and Maximum Carnage at the same time. You don't do the Phoenix Saga and the Dark Phoenix Saga in the same movie. You have to give these stories a little bit more room to breathe. And they were just, it's like that Ian Malcolm quote from Jurassic Park, right? You're so obsessed with the idea of whether or not you could, you didn't stop to think whether or not you should.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and just to close out, I would say to make a comparison, anybody who played the Maximum Carnage video game and then played its sequel, which was utter crap.
Was that Separation Anxiety?
Yeah. Basically, the drop in quality from Venom 1 to Venom Let There Be Carnage is almost as bad as that, I would say. Maximum Carnage was a good video game. Separation Anxiety has everything the first one has, but somehow does not quite. It just isn't as good. Mm-hmm. It's a year later, but it looks like an older game. It's you know, it's got the same characters, but they don't interact as much. And it's kind of, yeah, it's an interesting parallel there, I think, to draw the same problems with this movie. It's okay, but it's not as good as the first one.
Yeah, definitely. I think you can draw a similar comparison if you're comparing the Arkham games with Arkham City and Arkham Origins, which was clearly just an attempt to, you know, get a cash grab while Rocksteady was still trying to figure out if they wanted to do a third game.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely.
Okay, Liam, why don't you tell people where they can find you?
Okay, guys, if you're interested in football, or soccer, as you might call it in the States, I do two regular shows on YouTube. We do Celtic Down Under, which talks about Celtic Football Club, a Scottish football team. That's Monday evenings on YouTube. And then I also am a regular on A Celtic State of Mind, which also broadcasts YouTube weekdays at 12:30 UK time. So that's either 8:30 or 9:30, depending on the time of year, if you're in Japan like we are. So yeah, give those a listen, and you might find something in there to enjoy, even if you're not a football fan, because the banter is usually quite good.
Okay, great. And we are superherocinephiles.com is the website, as usual. We are Super Cinema Pod on Instagram and Blue Sky. Technically on Twitter or X or whatever the hell Elon Musk is calling it this week, although... other than new episode announcements, don't expect a whole lot of discussion over on there. Mostly you can find me on Blue Sky these days, is where I spend most of my time. Also, we got the Patreon show, patreon.com/superherocinephiles. And if you are interested, there's my comic book, Paragons of Earth, which I've worked on with Thomas DJ and Eric Johns. Tom was, of course, a guest on this show. When we did the Memorial episode for Derek, and him and Derek also used to host their own show, Better in the Dark. This guy I've known for a long time. And we brought on Eric Johns, who is a fantastic penciler. He used to work on the Razor comics in the 90s. And he's doing the pencils on Paragons of Earth. We've taken a lot of public domain superheroes and we've kind of made our own public domain Justice League. We are almost finished with the comic book, but we are funding it. And you can find the link for that in the show notes. It is crowdfunder.com/ParagonsComic. Again, that is crowdfunder.com/ParagonsComic. Again, links for that will be in the show notes, as well as links to the social media. Liam's links will be in there as well. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Superhero Cinephiles podcast. Superhero Cinephiles is produced by me, Percival Constantine, with the support of Zencaster. The show is created by myself and the late, great Derek Ferguson, our host emeritus. Visit us on the web at superherocinephiles.com to listen to past episodes or find out how you can be a guest yourself. Support the show by visiting our advertiser links or click the Buy Me a Coffee link on the website to make a one-time donation. You can also support us by visiting crowdfunder.com/ParagonsComic. That's crowdfunder with no E, .com/ParagonsComic, and help support my superhero comic book, Paragons of Earth. We are Super Cinema Pod on both Instagram and Blue Sky, so please be sure to follow us. We'd also appreciate if you could rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts and share us with your friends.